for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. I'm Sam.
Hi, I'm Anna.
And we are finishing up season one of Rebels with A Fire Across the Galaxy.
That is season one, episode 15. Fair warning, Sam has already cried twice today just thinking about this episode.
It's so good.
It is so good. It's emotional. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. It's heroic.
Mm-hmm. Before we get going, we want to give a shout out to the ongoing WGA SAG-AFTRA strike.
Yes, for the entire duration of Rebels Season 1, this strike has been ongoing. No movement yet. So even though Growing Up Skywalker is a non-union podcast, we do stand in support of the writers and creators who are part of this strike. We also want them to have better wages, better livelihoods, better everything. Mm-hmm. And you can help us out by maybe skipping the rewatch this week. So instead of driving traffic to platforms where these shows are being aired, it would be great if you can instead listen to our plot recap and maybe not give traffic to platforms that are being stricken against. It's just a little bit of leverage.
Yeah, because we are definitely nonprofit here. So
we are a nonprofit operation. We are actually operating at a loss, but that's fine. It's we love it.
We do.
So what happens in Rebels Season 1, Episode 15, Fire Across the Galaxy?
So to roll up the previous two episodes, basically Kanan's been captured and he's been transferred to Moff Tarkin's Star Destroyer, the Sovereign.
That's Grand Moff Tarkin to you?
G-Money. G-Money Tarkin is sitting there and he's ready to torture Kanan. However, the rest of the Ghost Crew has a plan. So we start off with an absolutely bonkers scene on an Imperial outpost as Sabine dodges 947 blaster shots, covers everything in graffiti and explosives as Ezra and Zeb steal a Gazanti class cruiser. They get up into orbit and they're like, okay, this ship is too big to dock with the Sovereign. What's the game plan? And reveal that the TIE fighter stolen in fighter flight not only was not crashed in the desert, it's still in great shape, and it's been in the process of undergoing an art transformation at the hands of the wonderful Sabine Wren.
Sabine has been turning it into a giant 70s disco ball. It looks like every girl's college dorm room Pinterest board. It has been tie-dyed.
Yes, and it is amazing. So apparently that's the plan. They're going to get up close and get a TIE fighter in. Meanwhile, Kanan is being tortured by the Grand Inquisitor. We learn a little bit about Kanan's backstory. The Grand Inquisitor is trying to get into his head, saying, "You were a coward. What is the last word your Jedi Master said to you?" And Kanan says, "Run." Oh, however, the rest of the Ghost Crew's plan is going off without a hitch. They fly this Gazanti in. They manage to infiltrate a TIE fighter in. And as the TIE fighter is the last one to land in the hangar bay, it's like the normal black and gray ties. And then this bright yellow and green and black checkerboard pattern TIE lands. The stormtrooper's like, "I don't know. I kind of like it." But we see that it's being piloted by a bunch of bombs, just bombs. It's just being piloted by ion bombs, which immediately go off and cripple the Star Destroyer.
Knocks out all the power.
And a bunch of the stormtroopers. However, Tarkin is prepared for this because he's like, "I've been sending the all clear signal like every minute with this little button. And so it's no longer going off. Reinforcements will arrive momentarily." The Ghost Crew docks the Gazanti on the side of the Star Destroyer, carves a hole through the wall, and starts making their way forward. Eventually, they're being chased because the reinforcements arrived way too fast, and Ezra has to split off and do his thing, which is climb through the vents. Ezra meets up with Kanan, and the rest of the crew runs off, and they split up. Now, here's where things get really crazy. Ezra is helping Kanan along, and they make it to the engine room where stands the Grand Inquisitor, who's ready to beat up everyone. And Kanan says, "I got this." He takes Ezra's lightsaber and starts dueling the Grand Inquisitor, including using the lightsaber and blaster back and forth. It is a fantastic fight. So Kanan's doing okay, but then they switch places and Ezra's sneaking up behind him and he sees Kanan's lightsaber on the back of the Grand Inquisitor's belt. So he grabs it using the Force and now it's a two-on-one fight and it's a little bit more fair. But Ezra is not actually good at lightsaber fighting yet.
He's really not. Poor baby.
Poor baby. So the Grand Inquisitor yeets his spinning lightsaber at him, slashes Ezra's face, and Ezra falls. And big no from Kanan. Kanan is down on the ground. No.
We cannot downplay the drama of this moment. Kanan is on all fours. Mm-hmm. He screams. He looks down at where Ezra fell. And then he looks back up at the Inquisitor.
But he's calm.
And he says, "That was a mistake."
Why? Because you have no one left to die for.
Because now I have nothing left to fear.
Kanan picks up both lightsabers, and now it is a real fight.
We see Kanan fully step into his power, and it is incredible.
Ezra wakes up from his little communicator, because Hera's like, "Ezra, are you alive? Ezra, what's on?" And Ezra's like, "Ah." Because he had actually only fallen like 20 feet and booped his head. And Hera's like, "How's Kanan doing?" And Ezra looks up, he's like, "Actually, like, really well."
Kanan is fighting the duel of his life, and he's doing great.
So the Grand Inquisitor is sitting there and he puts his lightsaber in full blend mode. But Kanan says, "I've discovered something far stronger than fear, the Force." And he shoves his lightsaber blades in between the handle of the Grand Inquisitor's lightsaber and slices it open.
And the Inquisitor goes flying.
And his lightsabers land on the reactor core, causing a meltdown. So on the backdrop of explosions, Kanan is looking down on the Grand Inquisitor, and the Grand Inquisitor is hanging by his hands, and Kanan turns off his lightsabers.
He's going to let the guy live.
He's going to let the guy live, and the Grand Inquisitor says, "You have no idea what you've unleashed here today. There are some things far more frightening than death," and lets go and falls into the reactor and is eviscerated by plasma.
We're going to have to talk about that one.
But then Ezra comes up and he's like, "Hey." And Kanan's like, "Oh, hey, you're alive. Great success."
They reunite. It is beautiful. It is also in the nick of time because the whole ship is self-immolating.
So Hera and Zeb and Sabine climb aboard Sabine's yellow TIE fighter special and fly off. Ezra and Kanan get there just in time. And all that's left is the Inquisitor's TIE fighter. And Ezra's like, "Well, he's not using it anymore, finger guns." So they climb aboard, they take off, and they are in an absolutely epic fight. The Sovereign is exploding. Tarkin is like, "Yeah, I gotta bounce." So he's in the escape pods, but there's still two Star Destroyers, each with 144 TIE fighters, and all 288 of those TIE fighters are out, about, and ready to pout. They're after the ghost crew in just two little TIE fighters.
Just one disco ball tie and one cool wiggly tie, and it's the two of them against everybody.
So importantly, when the reinforcements arrived immediately, Chopper, left on the Gazanti, was like panicking. He's like, "This is too much ship for me to fly. I don't know who to call for help." And he calls up Fulcrum and gets a, "This is Fulcrum, who's this?" So right as Hera says, "There's too many TIEs behind us," we look back, there's just an arbitrarily large number of TIE fighters.
Ezra's like, "Well, it was great to get to know all of you."
Out of hyperspace bursts the Gazanti, the Ghost, three blockade runners, and those noob TIE fighters get wrecked.
It's Chopper with the cavalry.
Chopper is singing his little song. The best theme of all of Rebels comes in. These blockade runners swoop in, destroy about 40 TIEs, and then everything lands together. The Gazanti picks up the TIE fighters and they go to hyperspace.
It is a rout. I never understood that war terminology before, but this was a rout.
Yeah, this was a hit and fade raid that took care of everything. No casualties, full successes,
blew up a Star Destroyer. So many embarrassed Imperials.
But as they're all in the Gazanti, the Ghost crew is like, "Hey, so Chopper is flying this thing. Who was flying the Ghost?" And down from the ladder comes a familiar character. And the Ghost crew says, "Oh, Fulcrum?" And the character says, The name's Tano, Ahsoka Tano. And reveals that she is connecting. She's Fulcrum. She is the one connecting them to the larger rebel cells. They're just one cell of a large group of cells. And Ezra's message of hope has made people rise up across the galaxy.
Ahsoka says, many people heard your message. It gave them hope in the darkest times. We didn't want that hope to die.
But we end the season on a slightly darker note. Tarkin in his shuttle is leaving, you know, the wreck of the Sovereign and lands on Lothal. And Agent Kallus is like, hey, so that went poorly. But Tarkin says, the Emperor has seen fit to dispatch an alternative solution. And from the gangplank of the shuttle comes Darth Vader is on the scene.
And we close the season on his mechanical breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Da-da, da-da-da. Wow!
That is season one of Rebels.
Oh my goodness.
So there are a few clues that Ahsoka is Fulcrum.
Please enlighten me, because I didn't see any of them.
So if we were watching in our in-universe order, the only clue is that on the box, on the asteroid base full of Schmonsters that Sabine and Hera go to.
Oh, in Out of Darkness.
Yes. Hera specifically grabs one of the boxes and she says, oh, I'll take care of this one. And that box has Fulcrum's symbol. And Fulcrum's symbol is Ahsoka's head tattoo, or like skin coloration symbol.
Oh, the orange and the white lines. Yep. Down her brow?
Yeah, like the two angled brackets and the two dots.
Like the one that the 501st painted on
exactly.
Their helmets? Oh, I completely missed that.
And then in our watch-through order, because season 7 of The Clone Wars comes after this, we learn that in the Battle of Mandalore, the Siege of Mandalore, when Ahsoka is like, hey, I need like a bunch of Mandalorians and some attack brigade of the 501st to liberate this planet from Maul, She calls Anakin and Obi-Wan using the codename Fulcrum, which is something Fulcrum had set up.
Are you kidding me? I missed that?
And Anakin said, oh, maybe it's Saw Gerrera, but it's actually Fulcrum because it's a whole channel. But now Ahsoka has assumed the mantle of Fulcrum.
I am literally so embarrassed that I missed that. It was right there.
There's only a few clues. Also, we listened to the Rebel Roundup before this, and Dave Filoni had specifically been like using different actresses and actors' voices for Fulcrum for the voice modulator. But the second time we see her, it's almost Ashley Eckstein. And in fact, she is the voice of Fulcrum in that episode. But it's like definitely some Ahsoka adjacent voice.
Yeah. So the Rebel Roundup, I think it's called Rebel Recon, A little bonus series of content on StarWars.com. And I do recommend watching them. I will say we watched the one for this episode immediately before recording, and we got a sneak preview of season 2, and they're introducing the Phoenix Squad. And we're just watching this footage, and I'm like, who are these people? And I look over at Sam, and he's just silently weeping.
I am so excited for the actual impact of this episode. This shows the whole role. So this is like a bookend for season 1. The pilot of this, we have Ezra captured by the Empire, and Kanan and the Ghost Crew go and rescue him. And in this one, the Ghost Crew goes and rescues Kanan. And Kanan is being browbeaten by the Grand Inquisitor. The Grand Inquisitor is saying, you're never going to be a good leader. You're going to lead your people to your death. You suck. And Kanan doesn't know anything and is like at peace with this. And it's Ezra who's leading the charge to get him back. So not only does it neatly bookend that, but we also have been planting these breadcrumbs throughout the first season of how there's more rebel cells and that the rebels are not alone out there. And just the fact that they recognize they're not alone out there is what sparks this fire and makes things just go crazy.
Well, and then the counter effect, right? Every action creates an equal and opposite action. Mm-hmm. We actually started the first scene of Rebels season 1 was Darth Vader. And then We closed the last scene of Rebels season 1 on Darth Vader being catalyzed into action.
Yeah, yeah. So the stakes have really escalated because, as we've talked about fairly often, Darth Vader is basically the biggest stick that the Emperor can wield unless he shows up personally, mm-hmm. which he does not do except for one time against the Brothers Opress. So.
I forgot about that. Oh, that was horrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, we end this season in a very different place than we started because mm-hmm. Grand Moff Tarkin swanned in and was like, you're bad at your job, you're bad at your job, you're terrible at your job, I'm going to do your job for you. And then he ends this season in shame. He got an F on his homework assignment. The rebels escaped his clutches.
Not only that, but they killed the Grand Inquisitor, and now the boss Inquisitor Vader is rolling up, being like, hey, if there's Jedi here, I need to take care of it.
It actually does make the Spectres look way better than they are, because nobody knows that the Grand Inquisitor Sudoku'd himself. It looks like Kanan and Ezra dispatched the big bad, minus Darth Vader, and just walked away.
Yeah, I mean, there's also that of you're beaten. And in the realm of like what makes one win a lightsaber fight, it's as much a battle of the wills as it is a battle of physicality. Mm. So Kanan did defeat him. And is the defeated Grand Inquisitor willing to deal with defeat? And he's like, no, I choose death.
Well, yeah. So I wanted to talk about that. Mm-hmm. Because I think the Grand Inquisitor seemed steadily more and more and more powerful this season. And, like, we finally see him living up to his name, really, in this episode. He's finally doing inquisiting. He is doing deep psychological screw-turning in Kanan's head, and it's horrifying. And he's also horrifying with a lightsaber. So this is the Grand Inquisitor at the peak of his power. Mm-hmm. And then Kanan, and we can talk about this later, overcomes him. And that's amazing. But what is the Grand Inquisitor so afraid of? That he lets go.
Vader.
Vader?
Yeah.
Like failing his homework assignment and having to go over to Vader and telling him why?
Like having his soul turned into snick snacks for Vader's shark tank on Mustafar.
Do you think that's what was going to happen to the Inquisitor?
I think it was probably that or something worse. I think Vader would be like, you have failed me. I spent however many years training you. You neglected to bring me Kenobi. You were there when and like let me go face Kenobi alone and get my butt whooped. I'm done with your BS and I'm feeding you to my sharks. And he's going to be like, but you don't have sharks. You live on a lava castle. He's like, I will make sharks out of lava and force ghosts, turn you into a shark, and then have the other sharks cannibalize you. And I'll make this happen forever. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that Vader would do. Or worse, Vader's like, nah, you failed me, but I'm just sending you to my boss.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So
this is a very toxic workplace. This is a hostile work environment. I don't like this for anybody.
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. But it's interesting to have the Grand Inquisitor appear in this as definitely the big bad. Definitely someone who's very scary to deal with. And then when he pulls out all the stops, when he's fighting Ezra and Kanan, he seems to revel in it. He's like, finally a worthy challenger appears. Mm-hmm. And yet he can't get inside Kanan's mind.
Yeah. So can we talk about Kanan?
Absolutely.
Oh my lordy. The Kanan lines in this episode are absolutely epic. The expression in his face. So I want to talk about how Kanan had the most dramatic leveling up of anybody in the whole season.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Because at the beginning of the season, it's, you know, he's just some dude until the 22 pickup. And then he's like, it turns out I'm a dude with a lightsaber. And I had like a sense of the Force. I kind of knew how things were going to happen before they happened. But now I need to actually assume the mantle of responsibility and start training Ezra.
Well, so here's my thought process. Kanan starts season one as a rogue. Mm-hmm. Just a scamp, a strategic mastermind. He's got a hot wife and a couple teenagers mm-hmm. and a very angry droid. And he's just going about making mischief, right? Then we see that he is a Jedi. And then we see that he's kind of still a Padawan?
Yeah.
But when he has to assume the mantle of teacher, he becomes a Jedi teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But my thought process in this final episode of season one is that Kanan finally got his trial. He finally graduated from Padawan to Jedi Knight.
Yeah, the trial of will, of recognizing that when he thought Ezra was dead, now he has nothing left to be afraid of, because the one thing he was afraid of has already come to pass.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking about this because we saw Ezra go through his trial in season one.
Mm-hmm.
He had to face up against, you know, force manifestation Yoda and get clarity on why he wanted to be a Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And then in our Patreon escapades, we've also been watching the 2003 Tartakovsky Clone Wars, where we see Anakin kind of skip out on a trial. He's supposed to do a trial to become a Jedi Knight,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't. And then that is a problem because he hasn't faced up against the thing that he needed to face up on.
Yeah.
And then even in season six of The Clone Wars, we saw Yoda had to go through a trial. He had to face his own pride,
mm-hmm.
and he emerged on the other side, stronger and wiser and better and more equipped to be a full Jedi. So I have this on the mind because we've seen so many examples of successful trials and then the really unsuccessful Anakin trial. And like, this was Kanan's trial. He had to face his greatest flaw, which is that he perceived himself as a coward.
He did. And then as he put things together, as he realized, I think, particularly when The Grand Inquisitor is saying, your master, Deepa Balaba, died in front of you. What were her last words to you?
Died for you.
Yeah. And he said, run. And it's because he couldn't do anything because he was a Padawan and she was presumably gunned down by clone troopers. And so he had to recognize in himself that that wasn't a failing. He did the right thing then, and he's doing the right thing now, and he's set up the rest of the ghost crew for them to do the right thing. And in fact, that's what they did when they came and rescued him.
Yeah, it feels like Kanan has been living in this prison of his own making. He believed that he was a coward for following Deepa's last order,
mm-hmm.
and so he's been kind of living like a coward. He's been slipping in and out of dicey situations, and he might show bravery in the moment, but he's not living like a brave person. And then he finally realizes what it feels like to not be afraid. And he realizes, I've had this inside of me all along.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what was blocking me from greater access to the Force. And then he steps into his own. He comes into his power. It was amazing.
And then he just absolutely easily beats the Grand Inquisitor.
Mm-hmm. Like it's nothing.
Because he is now tapping into the light side of the Force. He is no longer held back by fear. And he recognizes that the Force is far, far stronger than fear.
It's interesting to consider that even though Ezra has been a catalyst for Kanan's growth, I wonder if Ezra was kind of holding Kanan back too. Because Kanan loves Ezra so much,
mm-hmm.
but it was only thinking that he lost Ezra and didn't have to worry about Ezra that allowed Kanan to become so powerful.
Yes and no. That was the thing of the moment. I don't know how that would have played out differently. If Ezra had just been like sitting there and harrying the Grand Inquisitor with a lightsaber, then that would have resulted, and the Grand Inquisitor hadn't yeeted him off a cliff, then I think they still would have won the fight because the Grand Inquisitor just couldn't handle two reasonably well-trained Jedi fighting him.
Maybe. I think he could have.
It's interesting to me thinking about how the Inquisitors are probably used to coming across former Padawans who have had no lightsaber instruction.
Mm.
And because Kanan managed to escape and survive his first contact with Inquisitors. And then he's like, I'm practicing. I'm spending 8 hours a day in the dojo with the lightsaber because this guy's coming after me. And the next time he comes after me, I need to be like ready.
I just got the best vision of Eye of the Tiger playing while Kanan practices with his saber. Amazing.
And he's also been, because he is training Ezra, he's learning about his own connection to the Force, and Ezra's learning about his connection to the Force. So Kanan has been looking back on all the things he thought he knew that he had learned over the last 15 years and reevaluating every part of them and becoming his own flavor of Jedi, which I think is really cool because it's one that is incredibly powerful.
What flavor Jedi do you think he is?
He is one who is undefeatable in the realm of the physical. He can stop everything. He is a wall.
So he's in the style of Kenobi.
He is in the style of Kenobi, which makes sense because in the first time he meets the Grand Inquisitor, the Grand Inquisitor says, "You favor Form 3 to a ridiculous degree." And that's like the defensive way of doing things as well. So he's a very defensive Jedi. And that makes sense for him because a dude with a lightsaber who's just at the tip of the spear means that his crew, Chopper can hack things, Hera can airstrike things, Zeb can just yeet things, and Sabine can blow it up.
Blow everything up with such flair.
And so he is able to move everything forward behind him. He's a linebacker. And I think that works for him because he does have dad energy. He has the dad energy of like, give me a stick of jerky and a cup of espresso and I'll drive us across this damn country. Like, just, I'll be grouchy about it, but that doesn't matter because I'm burning on the deep reserves of not giving a crap about anything anymore.
And also, I think he is fueled by love, but he is no longer shackled by love.
The dad energy of, I love you enough to not actually give a crap about you anymore. That's the energy Kanan brings. He's like, I love you, I support you, and in this way, I'm going to sacrifice myself, my body, my everything to protect you.
Yeah.
And that is what he's doing now. And that's why when Ezra falls off, he's like, it feels like you should be afraid, Grand Inquisitor, because now I am unchained. I have nothing holding me back.
Kanan unchained.
Yeah. I mean, Kanan probably, if Ezra had been, you know, neatly bisected or something, Kanan probably would have been like, cool, I'm going to blow up the door and I'm going to blow up the reactor and I'll keep fighting so you can't stop the reactor from blowing up and we're both going to die.
Wow.
That's the type of energy that Kanan was bringing.
Kanan is actually such an interesting lesson, I think, for all of us, because he comes into this moment where he now loves Ezra. He knows that he loves Ezra, but he is detached from that love. And I think he took the best lesson of the Jedi, which is to not be attached. And so he's still connected to Ezra, but he's not attached to Ezra. And that is what psychologists are learning is the healthiest and strongest and most resilient form of love is when you are connected to someone and not attached to them. You don't take on their stuff as your stuff. And you have, like, liberation.
Yeah.
But you also have all the benefits of loving them and being loved by them in return.
So that's what Kanan is capable of doing as the Jedi, as who everyone assumes is the leader of the Ghost Crew. And he's just not.
He's just not. His beautiful, incredible wife is.
He's just the linebacker. And he makes things happen. But he's like, I don't know. I just lightsaber things and come up with schemes and plans. And I just brute force into problems.
And, you know, take down the second big bad of the Empire. Just cash.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he gets sacks, but he's a linebacker. He just the hustles.
Wow.
Wow.
Speaking of someone who has apparently been doing a lot of hustling in the last 10 years, do you want to talk about Ahsoka?
Oh, yeah.
So when did we last see Ahsoka?
We last saw Ahsoka in Tales of the Jedi.
So she is what, 17, 18?
Let's see here. She is like 17 in the OG Empire day, which makes her like early 30s now.
Okay, that makes sense. What was she up to? She, I think I remember, was masquerading as a farmhand on a random peaceful backwater village.
Yep.
And then someone gives her up to the Inquisitors and an Inquisitor comes, and in two moves, she turns him into two halves of one Inquisitor.
And she does that using his own lightsaber because she didn't bring one.
Oh, man, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
So what has led from that Ahsoka to this Ahsoka?
Well, I remember also in that Tales of the Jedi that Bail Organa was saying, hey, we could really use you.
Okay, yeah. She sneaks into Padme's funeral. Mm-hmm. She's about to yeet off into the distance where Rex is waiting for her. And Bail Organa does that whole subterfuge conversation.
Love that.
Where, like, the guards think that he's talking to them, but he's talking to her. And he's like, if you ever need anything, let me know. And they're like, okay, random senator, that's fine.
Yeah.
And then Ahsoka's listening in the darkness.
Mm-hmm. And then she runs off with the Y-wing that her and Rex took out of the ship at the very end of season 7.
So somewhere in the last 10 years, she, I guess, changed her mind?
A couple things have happened. One of them is in the Bad Batch, we see what Rex has been up to, because Rex is getting together a whole crew of clones to do some sort of clone rebellion.
He's been doing a pipeline of ex-Republic clone troopers to rebellion.
And then Ahsoka has been doing something different, and we have no idea what it is, but we know that here's what it involves. Bail Organa, as the contact, as the person who's sussing out these groups to see what they're all about, who's spying on them using R2 and C-3PO, Ahsoka is the point person for these different rebel cells.
Mm.
And when Chopper's like, I have this frequency, Hera's in trouble, the whole Ghost Crew's in trouble, you need to help, Ahsoka shows up with three rebel cells, or maybe just one, like well-equipped one with three blockade runners, and starts shooting everything up.
Hmm.
And those are like fast little picket ships. They can't take on a Star Destroyer, but in a cloud of TIE fighters, they'll do fine.
So is Ahsoka the leader?
Ahsoka is a leader. She's a very important member. I think she's more the person who organizes these cells, and she gives them like, hey, here's some useful information for you to act on, and I'd love it if you acted on this information. But it's not like she's running a war, because each of these individual rebel cells is like, they have their own little missions to do as well, and they have to be self-funding too.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be doing sketchy jobs with Sakatra Visago and the like, and as Morrigan, to make sure that they get paid from time to time.
It feels like Ahsoka's holding this massive, fragile, disconnected web mm-hmm. of rebel cells just in her fingertips, right?
Yeah.
When we watched the Rebels recap episode, Ashley Eckstein said, when we last saw Ahsoka, she was looking for answers, and now she's the one who has the answers.
Yeah, yeah, which is the attitude she brought to this as well, because she only has like 5 lines, but they're like, who are you? And she's like, I'm Ahsoka Tano. That's all you actually need to know.
Man, what a glow up. She has 4 armed guards just waiting on her at all times, which is so funny because she really doesn't need them.
No,
it seems more like an honor guard.
It definitely is. I think it's more now that they have the whole crew together, maybe those are like the liaison officers for the other rebel cells or something. It's something that somewhat is a little bit of a bummer about Rebels is that a lot of the mook imperial officers and rebel pilots and rebel guards like this are all just like a slightly different chin with a helmet that covers as much as possible.
Yeah.
Because to save on animation.
I saw that in the concept art at one point where the animators noted that all of the random Imperial officers need to have their mm-hmm. hats pulled down really low so you can't tell that they've just been copy-pasted.
They're very copy-pasted.
I mean, as a first-time watcher, I'm so swept up in the drama mm-hmm. and the plot that I would never notice that. So I think it's maybe the kind of thing that a long-term, like, long-time listener, first-time caller might pick up on, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't notice. It didn't detract for me.
But either way, the fact that the Ghost Crew has been so successful in what they have been doing and seems to be hitting that breaking point where they're like, we are no longer just like bandits. We are now rebels and we are in rebellion is also the defining call for other cells to be like, hey, yeah, we're not the only ones.
Mm.
Because that's why Grint and Orisko got decapped, you know? Because they're like, oh, there's other rebel cells. And Tarkin's like, cells, modules, tribes, everything. There's all sorts of groups. There's all these different groups. What they don't have is hope. And we need to keep that up.
And then unity.
And Ezra is like, hope. And Ahsoka's like, unity. And so now we have a rebellion.
Wow. They really fanned that spark into flames.
Yeah. And that's why Vader is dispatched now.
So yeah, we get that teeny tiny line from Agent Kallus right at the end of this episode where he says, there are uprisings all over Lothal.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know from seeing Lothal from space 1,000 times in this season, Lothal is really big.
It's a planet-sized planet.
A planet-sized planet. That could be a lot of uprisings.
Yeah.
So what do you think Vader is going to do?
Well, that's an interesting question. So we talked a little bit in previous episodes about how Tarkin is a big fan of what he calls the Tarkin Doctrine, which is just fear, mm-hmm. shock, awe.
Mm-hmm.
I think Vader is going to take that to its logical extreme. Now, recall in Kenobi, when the Inquisitors walk in and they're looking for Kenobi and Tala and Ned B in the Hidden Path. And the Inquisitors are like, oh yeah, well, we're going to beat these people up. And Vader grabs someone eating breakfast, chokes them out, slams them through their own window, and then drags their corpse behind him.
Not breakfast for dinner.
That's the type of thing that Vader's going to bring. He's going to make the planet wish that they had kept the Inquisitor alive.
Wow.
So he is going to really turn the screws. And that's what Tarkin is doing. And now Kallus is like, geez, Louise, guys. Like, he's just a cop, man. He's just a secret police. And he's really messing with some big operators now.
That's so interesting. Because when I think about Rebels Season 1 as a whole, mm-hmm. when I zoom out and I look at it through a telescope, I think one of the big themes of the season was fear.
Yeah.
And I think it was mostly the overcoming of fear. We see Ezra overcome his fear of being abandoned, and we see Kanan in this episode overcome his fear of losing the people that he loves. But now the Empire is swooping in and continuing to use and weaponize fear
mm-hmm.
to accomplish their own ends. So the very personal journeys that we saw in season one that were so hard won and so hard fought, we're, I think, now going to have to see the people of Lothal do the same thing.
And the people across the galaxy as they rise in rebellion.
Mm.
And as the message of rebellion spreads in A New Hope,
mm-hmm.
in the first 3 minutes.
Which we haven't seen yet. It hasn't happened yet.
But I feel comfortable referencing A New Hope because, like, people have opinions about Star Wars, but if you can break it back down to A New Hope and, like, this is what happened in A New Hope.
Give them the textual evidence.
Yeah, you really can't argue with that. Luke says, you know of the rebellion against the Empire? And he's like, people are rebelling against the Empire? I knew that, and I'm a farm boy on Tatooine.
Wow.
So the news had reached him, but it was still like underground news.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that that even exists means that the rebels are winning. The fact that there is a rebellion somewhere that you can go join up with.
How many years passed between the end of Rebels Season 1 and the beginning of A New Hope?
5.
5 years. So we have 5 more years to cover before we get there.
We do, but we're going to be covering them really fast. So Season 2 takes place in 4 BBY and then 3 and 2 BBY. And then the final episode of Season 4 of Rebels takes place like on brand during the events of the original trilogy.
Wow.
And so in the interim, we have Andor, which takes place in 5 BBY. But there's a lot happening in this 5 years to build up. And it's what's interesting to me about that is that that's actually kind of a slow time frame for a rebellion. But like the most successful rebellion is probably like the Chinese Civil War, which basically took place kind of between like 1939 and 1949, but it really kicked off in 1945 and 46 because the Chinese communists had been shoved way up in the mountains of like central China. And after Japan was, and they had been like sort of fighting with, sort of fighting against the nationalist Chinese during World War II, as well as fighting the Japanese. And then once the Japanese were defeated, the communist Chinese took over the rest of China in like 3 years. So the idea of a rebellion having like a very long burning fuse before it like lights up and it wins in just a few years, or just like takes over a huge amount of territory in a few years, it does have historical precedence.
Yeah, that does bring up the point that we know that Ezra was born on the original Empire Day when the Empire took over the Republic. So it's been 15 years since then, and it will be 5 further years before the rebellion, I guess, really picks up steam in the original trilogy. So 20 years is, I think, not a long time to organize a galactic rebellion, but it's a long time to keep people engaged in the rebellion.
That's very true. And I feel like people go in and out because early on, Ahsoka was out, as we saw in Tales of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. And at some point between Tales of the Jedi and now, she has become the fulcrum about which the Rebel Alliance bends.
It's just, it's a long time. And I have deep anxiety about this because Rex has been organizing this pipeline of former clone troopers. And they got the accelerated aging bug. Like 20 years is a long time for them.
We did see that 501st clone in Kenobi who was homeless and begging. And he looked worse for wear because that was actually Temuera Morrison playing that up. And so he's like, you know, his age. So
That dude had like white eyebrows.
Yeah, yeah.
So the clone troopers are going to be on their last legs, friends.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me anxious. But when you think about what it takes to go up against such a well-provisioned machine, which is the Empire, it is a military-industrial machine that has now spread to the furthest corners of the galaxy. Even 20 years doesn't feel like a long time to pull everything that they need together.
I think that the fact that the Empire is a purely military organization functionally, it's got bureaucracy and it like has a bunch of jobs, but it's not a infrastructure program. It's a military program. It does enforce through fear as opposed through like through commerce. And if it worked through commerce, then people would be all about it and they would oppress themselves. But because the Empire is an external oppressor, it spread super thin.
Yeah. Well, and we have seen on Lothal all season that the Empire has turned Lothal away from the industry that made it prosperous before. Mm-hmm. They had fishing. They had mining. They had other stuff going on. And now apparently they're not doing any of those things. They're just making TIE fighters.
Yeah.
So really, maybe people realize they would be fine without the Empire.
Isn't that funny? Because they're presumably also taxed out their ears to like keep the Empire in place. And there's like, you know, military everywhere. And this is what we see all over the place. We saw that on Corellia in Solo, that there's like crime lords everywhere and the Empire is fine with it because it makes ships for them. And so the Empire is at this remove. It's not your day-to-day. It's not indoctrinated into you that the Empire is good. It's propagandized into you. And it's visible when they're there, but they're actually only rarely there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about this in a previous episode about how because the Empire's retribution against crimes is almost always lethal and it's almost always instant, that has a deterrence effect. And people won't want to go against the Empire until they realize that everyone is going against the Empire. And then they're like, they can't fire all of us. So that's the game plan. That's what Ezra did.
This is a little bit outside the realm of what I studied when I studied political science in my undergrad, because I had a focus on nonviolent revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And the key number, this is from Erica Chenoweth's research. She's amazing. She's at CU Boulder. The key number with a nonviolent revolution is that you need just 3% of the population to buy in order to overthrow a regime, which is like when you put it in tens of thousands of people, it's a fair number of people. But when you put it in the scope of a population, it's not a big slice of the pie. Now, what gets difficult is that when you're trying to foment a violent rebellion, this is where you start to lose people.
Yeah.
Because people who might be comfortable marching with their signs and picketing in the streets are not comfortable picking up a brick and throwing it at a stormtrooper, right? So The fact that this rebellion is going to presumably have to be a violent one makes this a more difficult uphill climb. But because this is a military empire, there's really no other course. So I think what I would predict, based on what I know about revolution, this is going to be bloody. It's going to be an uphill battle. It is not going to be easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably going to cost a lot of lives on both sides.
Definitely. I mean, so the crew of a Star Destroyer is something ridiculous, like 20,000. They're packed in there like sardines. And these guys blew up a Star Destroyer today.
Wow.
And there were probably survivors. They had a couple minutes to get out, but there were stormtroopers like climbing aboard TIE fighters and getting ready to go. So, and then, you know, if you do get aboard a TIE fighter and leave, then the Empire will probably just leave you behind and be like, you're all left to your own devices. You have a TIE fighter. We might shoot you. They're just terrible. They don't have any actual governance.
Hmm.
All they have is the fear.
Wow. Seems kind of flimsy when you got people like Kanan leveling up like a Pokemon.
Yes, but Darth Vader just arrived on scene.
That's true.
And Darth Vader is extremely scary. Also, Darth Vader has had 5 years to level up since his last time we saw him.
He's had his own Eye of the Tiger montage, just raging against letting Kenobi slip through his gloved fingers.
And with coming up with his new plans and doing his own things. And we know from like the comic books and other works that Vader is continually given like tasks and trials and tests by the Empire, by the Emperor. The Emperor is continuously like, go kill this monster. And whenever there's like an actual scary Jedi out who's not just a Padawan, like if it's just a Padawan who's untrained and who still uses the Force and waves a lightsaber and causes problems, they send the Inquisitors. If it's an actual Jedi, they send Darth Vader. So apparently Kanan has registered on the radar as an actual factual Jedi, and it's time to send in Darth Vader to clean up the job.
Wow. So here's the thing. The people have spoken. Mm-hmm. We are not going to continue into Rebels Season 2. Instead, we're going to jet across the galaxy and join up with whatever's happening in Andor Season 1.
Yeah.
So are we going to see anyone of the Spectre crew in for Andor? A while?
Not until we're done with Andor
Season 1. Man. Yeah. It's just we're on this precipice with Rebels, and now we're going to have to turn away from them.
You're going to love it. I promise you, you're going to love Andor. Andor is all the parts that are happening where in the other cells, in what these people are doing, in the nature of things. It's not a bunch of found family riding around in a starship blowing stuff up. It's who is telling them what stuff to blow up and why.
Ooh, okay. So it's more of like the nexus of the rebellion.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're going to dig it.
Okay. That's exciting. I'm primed to love Andor because people say that Andor is similar to Kenobi. And I loved Kenobi.
Yeah.
So I'm ready.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
I'm very ready for Andor.
Okay. Well, let's then wrap up our thoughts on Season 1 of Rebels. What did you think overall?
Oh, it was such a good rewatch for me. I've always loved Rebels. The fight scenes are really fun in this. It's awesome to see like Sabine scamper about, leaving explosives everywhere.
Just leaping around like a freaking Jedi on that landing pad.
And it's awesome to see all of the crew get together. And even though we haven't really unlocked all their backstories, we've learned so much about who they are, and they're working together. And everyone gets a heroic moment.
Mm.
Chopper had a heroic moment in this episode where he's like, hello, I wish to place a collect call to Fulcrum. I have real big problems here. And then he gets to fly in screaming his own theme song because he's having the most fun. So everyone gets to have a really powerful experience. And the interactions between the Ghost crew is so meaningful. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I just love it. And now we've started with this spark of rebellion of wanting to tell a story of what does it mean to be a rebel in the Age of Empire. And now we're like, okay, this is what it means to be part of a rebellion in the Age of the Empire.
Mm-hmm. My big thoughts on Season 1 were that it was so tight. It was tight. It was clean. There were no dropped plot points, right? Mm-hmm. If something appeared, it always came back. The TIE fighter from Fight or Flight came back in the finale. Zeri Leonis, who we met in the middle of the season, got a second episode.
Yeah.
I think even, like, Mailu runs were a big plot point, and they come back multiple times.
Yeah, Mailu run fruit.
So this was just so much cleaner than Clone Wars. Clone Wars had loose threads everywhere, and yeah. Rebels just had this tight ball of yarn.
I think part of that's also because we've now watched enough Star Wars to see all the threads. We know how these things are going to go. And we still recognize it because, like, Kurt Vonnegut talked about what good writing is for TV or books or whatever. And it's, you got to surprise people, and people love to see a good person down on their luck get better.
Yeah.
And that is what the plot of this is. There's surprises. There's people who are making it. They're, you know, the Ghost Crew is surviving, but they aren't thriving until they get together, until they add Ezra, until they level up into Jedi. And now they're a full-fledged Rebel cell.
I would add a little bit, not to say that Vonnegut is not, you know, an expert on this. What do I have to add?
Oh, yeah. There's more to add to that.
Yeah. I would say people love to be surprised, but people love even more to be surprised and then trace the breadcrumbs back.
Oh, yeah.
And see how the plot twist happened and was realistic. I think that's what separates something like Rebels, where you see the seeds having been dropped and can go back with full knowledge and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I missed it. And something like, I mean, I think a classic example is the final season of Game of Thrones, where the showrunners went on record and said, too many people guessed what we were going to do, so we just decided to do something different, even though it wasn't earned.
Yeah.
And the feeling of dissatisfaction you get from something like that is just in direct contrast to the feeling of satisfaction that I had from Rebels season one, which just knew what it was about and knew what it was doing. Mm-hmm. There was a vision here and they really followed through on it.
Agatha Christie talked about that when she writes her, like, you know, murders. Mm-hmm. And people are like, how do you know who the murderer is? Like, do you know the whole time? And she's like, no, it's like, it's only obvious to me at the same time it is to the reader. Like,
wow.
Like, you lay the clues such that it's strange enough that anyone could be the murderer, and that's what makes it so difficult. But then as the clues are removed, you're left with just, like, the one person, and of course that's the murderer.
Mm.
And I love that as a storytelling device, and I think Rebels does it really well too. It's a very tightly run show. That's partially because it's got Dave Filoni doing all the emotional pulling together how people are going to feel, what characters are doing. These characters live fully fleshed inside of his head. Mm. And then you have Pablo Hidalgo, who is closely aligned with what's going on in this, as far as here is the entire lore of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really, really important because the great canon decanonization of Star Wars happened, you know, relatively early before this. It happened in like 2014, 2013. And that's like when this is happening. And so redefining what canon is and including the Rebels as the first vanguard of the new canon means that the whole story can be more realistic, it can be focused on more interesting stories rather than just a father and a son and a lightsaber. There's other people in the universe, and everyone is a member of the Rebels crew.
Wow.
Everyone can see themselves in one member or the other. Sometimes I'm Zeb, sometimes I'm Kanan, sometimes I'm Chopper. Sometimes I'm Sabine, but
I have been deeply inhabiting my Hera energy. Yeah. I'm in my Hera era. I love that for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's startlingly competent. You're like wry. You're having fun all the time, even in dangerous situations.
I just bought a new SUV and now I feel like a mom in a minivan. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I got room for so many teenagers back here.
Yeah.
And the groceries.
Mm-hmm.
And like someone passenger side. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. I will say Rebels as a series has the best Rotten Tomatoes scores I've ever seen. Like season one has a 92 and then the rest of the seasons have 100%. I've never seen that before.
That checks out. Well, we've talked a lot about a lot of characters. There's a few we missed, but let's get into Baywatch.
It's time for Baywatch.
All right. Who's it going to be for the season one finale and maybe season one as a whole, if you so desire, for Baywatch?
I don't feel prepared necessarily to do a season one Baywatch. I'm going to focus on season finale Baywatch because this is so clear to me. It's got to be Kanan.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so what I came to realize as we were talking is that you have said to me that you feel like the Grand Inquisitor is kind of a butt monkey.
A little bit, yeah. Grand Inquisitor, he starts off and he's never the scariest person in Kenobi where he's introduced. And he's never the scariest person in Rebels season one because you know that the Rebels are going to be able to go past him. And then he's so full of misplaced pride. Hmm. In the first fights with Kanan, the Inquisitor beats him handily. But then Kanan catches up, levels up. And then by the time they're fighting for like the third time, Kanan has got him up against the ropes. Mm-hmm. Because the Inquisitor knows all these things. Like he calls out, "You're Deepa Balaba's student. I know this." But Kanan is like in the backyard actually training. And he has something to live for. And he's actually doing the Jedi things of having a Padawan, of protecting others. He's becoming a Jedi.
Yeah. I mean, I can't relate to the Grand Inquisitor butt monkey thing. I think the Grand Inquisitor was very scary. I think he was a very worthy foe, which is why I'm picking Kanan as my bae, because Kanan does something so cool. And it's so cool to look back over the course of the season, because what I realized as we were talking is that the whole season one, the Grand Inquisitor was fighting Deepa Balaba's Padawan. Mm-hmm. And then it's not until the season finale, when Kanan comes into his own, that the Grand Inquisitor is finally fighting Kanan Jarrus.
Yeah.
Just as himself, as a Jedi Knight, as a Jedi mentor, as a teacher, as a father, as a husband, as a lover, like all of the things that make Kanan who he is, he brings to bear in their most powerful form on the Grand Inquisitor, and then he's unstoppable.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it is so cool to think about someone transforming themselves, shaking off their old self and becoming something shiny and powerful and new. Mm-hmm. When we saw Sabine explode the landing pad, there was that beautiful cloud that looked like a phoenix. And like Kanan is the phoenix. Kanan burned off his old self and became something new.
I want you to bookmark that concept.
Okay.
We're going to revisit it in season four.
Season four. Okay. So just hold on to it for 6 months?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I think I can do that. I'm sad now.
Well, I'm also choosing Kanan.
Oh.
Yeah. And I think that's for all the reasons you enumerated, as well as the fact that he gets just the absolute bomb lines in this one. All of his, every line he has hits like a truck.
Best lines of dialogue all season.
Yeah. And he wins a lightsaber fight versus a Grand Inquisitor. I mean, that's very cool.
Shoved two lightsabers through the steering wheel of the Inquisitor's spinning lightsaber blades.
Which is also how Ahsoka defeated the Inquisitor that came after her in Tales of the Jedi. She reached her hands through and grabbed the lightsaber and was like, nope.
God, now. That's so cool.
Well, it's pretty scary, but
yeah, I mean, you could definitely just mincemeat your hands doing that. And then they don't.
And then they don't.
Wow. Okay. Two more votes for Kanan. I think that puts him at least in the top 15 of Baywatch ever. So that's pretty impressive.
That is impressive because the Rebels don't, there's a lot of them to spread around and there's just not as many episodes. The Clone Wars had a lot of weight in Baywatch.
It did. We're going to claw our way back. I will say Ahsoka Tano is head and shoulders above anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's Star Wars and Ahsoka story. So
yeah, I feel that. I love that. I claim that energy.
Anna.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what we're doing next?
I do. We are next watching Andor Season 1, Episode 1, first premiered on September 21, 2022, Casa?
And what's great about that, I actually watched this only a few months ago, and so it's still very fresh in my mind. We're in for a long, slow burn with some real emotional weight. It's one of those things where you get to the end of it, and you're like, oh, that was good.
Nice. So, I love a slow burn.
Yeah. And so as we enter into spooky season, we're going to be having a little bit of a little bit less heroics and a lot more spicy stuff.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Rogues and spies and traitors and rebels and all
assassins,
that
assassins, saboteurs, all the good stuff.
Love a good saboteur. Mm-hmm. Well, follow along. Make sure that you hit the little alarm bell on your podcast subscription platform so that you don't miss an episode. And if you love Growing Up Skywalker and you want more, you can follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, because I refuse to call it X anymore, and Threads. We are also on Patreon.com. So if you want bonus weekly audio content, you can become one of our monthly subscribers. It starts at just $3 a month. And like, you cannot even buy a latte for that anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be a great investment if you want more Skywalker.
And it helps us pay for the subscriptions to Audition, or for editing, and for hosting our website, and all the stuff that we got to do. I mean, this is a labor of love, but, you know.
We do love it.
We do love it.
The last thing you can do to support Growing Up Skywalker is just drop us 5 stars if you like what we're doing, and you can even leave us a review. And that just really helps us to get into more people's headphones.
I'm a big fan of sending this episode to someone. And in this case, send it to the daddiest dad who ever dadded.
Oh, yes. Even if they just have daddy dad energy.
Even if they're, you know, a single mom working 2 jobs. Even if they're a dog, play it for dogs. Play it to someone who inhabits dad energy, because this was the dad energy season.
Oh, I'll send it to you, Sam.
Aw, wait. Do you know something I don't?
You're just daddy. And we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.